The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hey, it's The Takeaway from Monday, October 24th, 2016. We have a brand new way for you to make your voice heard. Here's the deal. 1. Download the PRI app. 2. Click on The Takeaway. 3. Click on Voice Memo. 4. Click the record button. 5. Either press preview or send. We'll get your take in full quality and we might play you on the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Get big or fail. That's the desperate solution to the current turbulence in the media industry. As Netflix, to use one example, tries to stay afloat, creating content it can't own, AT&T wonders how it can survive selling phones and phone numbers without having a piece of social media's limitless eyeballs or some programming that will bring people to AT&T for some other reason than needing customer service. Hence the merger. AT&T has officially announced its plan to purchase Time Warner for nearly $85 billion. Jason Abruzzi's business editor for Mashable. There's no way the FCC is going to let this happen, right?
If I had to bet, I think it probably does go through, but it's going to be a slog. This is going to be a battle that goes on for a while.
We'll come back to that slog in just a moment, but we are also looking at the turbulence in down-ticket political races all across the country. We're looking at how peace in Colombia is a much bigger deal than peace prizes, and we're going to take a stab at that turbulence of the race conversation in America transformed by events in the 21st century. The AT&T Time Warner merger would potentially be the biggest of its kind in history, folks, creating one of the most powerful media companies in the world, giving AT&T control over entire swaths of entertainment genre, everything from HBO's catalog.
She knows how to manipulate him.
Good. I wish you knew how to manipulate him.
To cable news with CNN or professional basketball on TNT.
Allen for three.
Even the Batman or DC superhero movies, which are all owned by Warner Brothers.
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you?
When people watch CNN, are they getting an independent assessment and reporting of the news? The last thing we want to do as AT&T is in any way taint that in the slightest bit.
Randall Stephenson, chairman and CEO of AT&T, suggesting that control doesn't mean control. As he talks about this merger, Jason Abruzzi's his business section editor for Mashable. Jason, thanks for helping us out here.
Appreciate it.
Biggest media company in the world. What does that mean anymore?
It's going to be mean scale. It means how many people can you touch and then how much stuff can you make? That's really the end all and be all. There's nothing else to it.
Time Warner is this giant island of stuff and AT&T is this desperate island of just phones. And they've got to go somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, phones, there's a little bit of internet, there's a little bit of cable TV, but yeah, it's just a distribution company. It specializes in getting stuff from one place to another. It doesn't do much beyond that.
But the FCC, which approved NBC Comcast, why would they look at this askance?
I mean, I think a lot of people look back at the NBC Comcast deal and wish it didn't go through. And we've been interesting to see how the discussion around these mergers has changed since then. People have grown very, very skeptical of these companies pairing together, what it means for consumers, what it means for other companies in the space trying to be competitive. They don't want, these kind of mega companies to squeeze out every kind of middle tier, lower tier company. That's not good for consumers. It's not good for the economy.
What does this mean for on demand? If AT&T pulls this off, can they set prices for virtually all on demand stuff that's owned by Time Warner?
I wouldn't go that far, and they're going to be very, very cautious to do that, because if they start doing that, they're going to make a lot of people very angry. And making a lot of people very angry in this kind of deal is the last thing they want to do. So I think they're going to be very, very cautious. They're going to tiptoe into that. We might see some certain deals, but I would be surprised if we saw anything major on the consumer side.
It used to be the only thing that consumers cared about was their cable bill. Now it's the on-demand price point plus the cable bill plus their phone bill and whatever data charges they get depending on how much content they view on their mobile devices.
Yeah.
How does AT&T Time Warner get control of that, or is it still going to be a consumer chaos?
what AT&T sees is, like, we're trying to sell all those services, and you summed it up perfectly. There's no more, we're just selling TV, we're just selling cable, we're just selling wireless. They're selling everything. They're trying to sell all of that to as many people as possible. One of the ways you can make your package more appealing, aside from price, is to say, we got a little few extras, maybe a little bit of better content, maybe a few more exclusives. Maybe you can get Game of Thrones on your phone a little easier. There's certain perks they can do when they link up these companies, and that's where we might start to see an effect on the consumer side, where AT&T starts using things like zero rating, not to get too wonky, but this is the big thing in the wireless sector now, which is basically you have your wireless plan, you're trying not to use too much data, so the company says, well, you can go ahead and stream Game of Thrones for free if you're on AT&T. Ooh, all of a sudden AT&T seems a lot more appealing. I'll go buy the AT&T plan.
But that seems like a transitional moment. Ultimately, the consumer is going to go, hey, this is great if somebody can figure out how to bundle the entire package into a single login on all your devices, and basically you get everything without having to do any sort of passwords, any sort of with just one company. Is anybody capable of doing that yet?
AT&T is probably closest at this point because they do have the whole range. Comcast is working to get there. There have been reports, I think confirmed now publicly, that they're going to try to launch a wireless network. So you're going to be able to get Comcast for your phone like you do AT&T and T-Mobile. Comcast are obviously already a huge cable and broadband distributor. So they're absolutely racing to get to that endpoint where they can offer you that one complete package at a, you know, maybe a slight markup, but, you know, the convenience, the bundling, those are the kind of things that consumers have already shown that they want and that they'll pay a little bit more for.
So suddenly the pipeline doesn't matter. It's the brand of the company that owns all the pipelines simultaneously and can sell the service simultaneously. Is that the way it's going?
Yeah, I mean, it's the pipeline's the one and the same here. I mean, they're basically all trying to throw these services together because they realize somebody who's watching something on TV is probably going to at some point try to watch it on their phone, is probably at some point going to try to watch it on their computer, and you kind of want to be everywhere and at all those touch points. And if you can offer that service and make it really usable and convenient, that's something that, you know, people want and that people are going to maybe pay a little bit more for. And if you get there first and you have some content to back it up, that's a very, very persuasive kind of, you know, bundle for consumers.
The FCC shuts this down. How bad is that for AT&T? Because Verizon has now got a head up.
It's bad if this doesn't go through. They're going to face billions of dollars in break fees. I think the Wall Street Journal actually had a report come out last night showing that if the FCC strikes it down, I think it's at least $1 billion they have to pay to Time Warner. If somebody actually comes in and overbids, they're going to owe money too here. So this is a risky proposition. This is no safe bet. This is a bold move, but something that AT&T probably had to do. They couldn't not do anything.
Jason Abruzzese is business section editor for Mashable. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
We're almost there. The election of 2016 is just 2 weeks away, and there's an eerie silence in the air. Is it because we think we know what's going to happen now, or because we're all just shell-shocked by what's happened so far? Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, what's the state of the race on this Monday?
Now, the state of the race is, gosh, just about a 7-point lead for Hillary Clinton nationally. I'm sort of eyeballing it because there are so many polls and they're kind of all over the map. 7 points, just to put that in perspective, if that's the real lead, and Democrats say their lead is actually a little bit better than that in their internals, John, is about halfway between the Romney defeat, which was 4% in 12 to President Obama, and kind of that double-digit, you know, possible bloodbath that Hillary Clinton would love to have and run up the score, which is part of the story this week, to try to give her as big a mandate as possible, crush any ideas of a rigged election, and really show that she can defeat soundly the phenomenon of Trumpism. And I say trying to run up the score. Hillary Clinton is now playing in Arizona. People may have seen that. She got a big endorsement over the weekend, by the way, from the president and vice president of the Navajo Nation. People pay scarcely little attention to Native American tribes, John, in election time. But that's a big endorsement because there are 100,000 Native American voters in Arizona. Hillary Clinton really thinks she's going to play there. It would be a massive win for Democrats. Meanwhile, you know, you said the election is 2 weeks away, and that's true. Do you know that nearly 6 million people have already voted, John, in early voting? It's an astounding number. Early voting, in-person early voting starts today in Florida, the big one. This is the first day that Floridians can actually actually go to the polls, vote early. They've been voting by mail absentee already, where it appears that Democrats have eroded a traditional Republican lead there. Those numbers don't mean a whole lot because it's a small number of votes. Early voting also started in Nevada over the weekend and in North Carolina just before the weekend, John. And I want to point out something in North Carolina that really jumped out to me from over the weekend. Kind of a big deal. We've covered a lot on the show about some of the restrictive voting laws in North Carolina. There have been lawsuits, of course, and a lot of controversy over the altering of early voting and access voting in North Carolina. Many counties in North Carolina, John, have scaled back their number of in-person early voting locations. It's different in every county, but Guilford County, North Carolina, we're talking Greensboro, pretty big county, about 520,000 people. Now, Guilford County drastically scaled back those number of places where you can vote in person from 2012 to today in 2016. In 2012, they had 16 in-person early voting places. This year, it's just one, right in the center of the county in Greensboro. And after doing that, listen to this, in 2012, in the first 2 days of early voting, so Thursday and Friday, 21,560 people voted back in 2012. This year, only 3,300. That's a reduction of 85%. Now, every county, like I said, is different. They're not all as egregious as Guilford County, but that's one example there in Guilford where the access to early voting has drastically cut the number of people who are actually able to cast their votes ahead of Election Day.
So that could extrapolate to about 200,000 votes, maybe?
Well, it could early. Now, everybody has Election Day, of course, and they do have 2 weeks of early voting, but the early voting they've had so far in person over the first few days of early voting compared to 4 years ago is down 85%. Other counties haven't cut back their in-person as much as Guilford has, but Guilford is one example where those places have been cut back and early voting has drastically gone down because it's just not as convenient, not nearly as convenient.
Meanwhile, your home state of Pennsylvania is an absolute circus of campaigning, of candidates. Everybody's focused on Pennsylvania.
Always. It's starting to slip away for Donald Trump, and there are lots of internal numbers that show that he's in trouble there, and I'll give you just a couple. One on the national scene, an ABC poll out over the weekend, those tracking polls tend to come out every Sunday now. Donald Trump appears in that poll to be ahead by about 4% among white voters. White voters are critical in central and western Pennsylvania where Donald Trump has to win. He's up by about 4% with white voters, and if that sounds good for Donald Trump, Mitt Romney won them by 20%. So he is drastically underperforming there. And the other number, last week we talked briefly about waning Republican enthusiasm for the vote. John, those numbers are sinking even further for Donald Trump at this point. The internals in that ABC poll show another 7% drop since October in Republicans who say they're enthusiastic and likely to vote. If those numbers hold for Donald Trump, not only does it get difficult for him in places like Pennsylvania, but the down ballot people who are trying to thread the needle with Donald Trump, folks like Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, have a harder and harder time if those folks aren't coming out to vote.
We'll take a look at that turbulence later this hour. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent with the State of the Race. Thanks, Todd.
You got it, John.
We want to let you know that you have the power to add your voice to the conversation. It's sitting right in your hand. Go to the App Store on your phone. You can download the PRI mobile app and record a voice memo to have your comments heard on The Takeaway. Again, go to the App Store, search PRI, and download the app. Find The Takeaway and click on Voice Memo to record your comments and send them straight to us.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Turbulence, turbulence, turbulence. In the last weeks of the campaign, the big splits are starting to be seen in state and local races as confused voters on the left and right try to find a home. In Pennsylvania, incumbent Pat Toomey wasn't going anywhere near campaigning Donald Trump as he fights to save his own Senate seat. New Hampshire's Senate race has quietly, due to outside spending and large fundraising efforts, become the most expensive in state history. Republican Kelly Ayotte, who's running for her second term, is one of many members of Congress who has renounced her support for Donald Trump in recent weeks. Her challenger is the state's governor, Democrat Maggie Hassan. Josh Rogers is the senior political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome to The Takeaway, Josh.
Hi, John.
Strange music there in New Hampshire politically this campaign.
It is. A lot of loud noise flowing downward from the presidential race. You know, Hillary Clinton's here today, for instance, with Elizabeth Warren and with Maggie Hassan at her side on the GOP side. You know, Kellyanne and other Republicans have been kind of trying to dance away from Trump to the best of their abilities, and we'll see how that pans out.
In the state where, you know, Republican loyalty is seen as a real, you know, as a real principle, can you denounce Donald Trump and still be seen as a, you know, true blue Republican?
Well, Kellyanne certainly hopes so. And there are indications that, some believe that that's a possibility. But, you know, Democrats have won five of the last six presidential years here with the Democratic presidential nominee. And so, you know, coattails are a thing. And, you know, New Hampshire is where Donald Trump won first. He won big here and he had a lot of votes here. So Kellyanne's been trying to negotiate, you know, a sticky situation and her transit from, you know, originally it was I'm going to support but not endorse. And then, you know, a couple weeks ago in a debate, she said he was absolutely could be seen as a role model for children. And then she said she misspoke. And then after the Access Hollywood Billy Bush tape came out, she said his remarks were inappropriate and offensive. And then a day later, as an imam and an American, she couldn't support Trump. And then a day after that, she said, you know, it's important to me that my daughter knows where I stood, and that's more important than winning any election. So, you know, Trump has really been a headache for Ayotte at a minimum.
Yeah, I'm dizzy, Josh. You recited that perfectly. I'm astounded. Is there a feeling among conservative New Hampshire voters who are known for taking positions that are out of the mainstream, endorsing revolutionary change within the party, that this time around they've been burned?
Well, I think among establishment types, sure. I mean, among the true Trump believers, you know, if they have any lack of confidence, they don't betray it. But, you know, the people who look at the numbers, it's, you know, it's been a drag. The most recent poll out of UNH and WMUR had Clinton up 15. And
oh my God.
While Ayotte and other Republicans have generally outperformed Trump, you know, if assuming that poll is at all accurate, you're not going to outperform him to that degree. So, you know, the argument has recently been in favor of ticket splitting. And, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, started an ad up here saying that, you know, Kellyanne could be a check on a Clinton administration. Over the weekend, the New Hampshire Union Leader, the state's largest paper, made a similar point, saying essentially whoever is president, we need Ayotte as a check, be that on Hillary Clinton or, you know, less likely be that on Donald Trump.
Does the Ayotte as a check strategy work for her, or is that desperation in the final weeks?
Well, maybe her only route, but, you know, maybe it works. It's hard to know. I mean, both Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan are pretty popular among voters. And, you know, there's been, you know, reams, you know, buckets of money, $80 million at this point, and it's sort of blanketing the region's TV markets. And it's hard to know. I mean, in some ways, both Ayotte and Hassan are sort of like off the rack members of their own party. I mean, they've been trying to position themselves as who's the more independent and bipartisan. But, you know, on most issues, they pretty much hew to their party's message. And, you know, both are well liked. You know, Ayotte's only been in one election back in 2010. She won that in a wave year. You know, polling indicates she still has a chance, certainly. But you know, the wind seems to be in her face.
And the noise is definitely just like primary time in New Hampshire, only it's just 2 weeks from the general election. Josh Rogers, thanks so much.
Good to be here, John.
Josh Rogers is the veteran senior political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. And, well, that's the down market turbulence. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. And let's dig deeper now. Elections for district attorneys have historically been relatively uncontested and depoliticized around the country. But this year, with reform in the criminal justice system in the air nationally, many local voters are seeing the position as a way to effect an immediate change in their communities. Even some deep-pocketed political donors known for playing on the national stage are getting involved. Maurice Chama has been following this for the Marshall Project. He joins me now. Maurice, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So district attorneys, they are platforms to statewide office sometimes mm-hmm. in New York and California.
But this year is really transforming the focus.
It is, yeah. For years and years in district attorney elections, you would traditionally see relatively uncontested, relatively low budget races in which the incumbent would kind of come out and say, I am getting convictions, I'm putting people away, I'm keeping, you know, dangerous criminals off the streets, and they would get reelected. This year, however, in a lot of the races around the country, in the primaries over the last year, and then in a few key races this November, you're seeing kind of a rhetoric around criminal justice reform. And so the sort of door has opened to talking about the treatment of rape victims, talking about the death penalty, talking about whether too many African Americans are being swept up in the system.
These How's that issues. Being talked about? Are candidates campaigning on, I'm going to seriously address the ratio of African Americans to other people in prison?
They are. They're talking about it, and they're talking about all the sort of policy details of that for low-level drug crimes. You know, I'll set a new course where we're going to give them citations instead of prison time. I'm going to create a wrongful conviction unit to uncover situations where somebody has gone to prison and shouldn't have gone. You're seeing challengers basically in these races, often kind of younger up-and-comers, sometimes themselves of color, though not always, sort of challenging these incumbents who have been around for a long time or who are, you know, kind of the successors to the district attorneys that have been in office for decades.
Is this a grassroots district-to-district kind of phenomenon?
It is.
So it's not partisan. It's not the Democratic Party aligned with some sort of uber sort of strategist?
No, not exclusively. I mean, a lot of these upsets, there were a lot of upsets over the last year in primary races, both Democrat and Republican, in which these sort of insurgent challengers talking about criminal justice reform beat their own party's nominee. And the one exception to that is that in a handful of these races, George Soros has gotten involved.
He's the big player, I refer to.
George Soros has been donating through his political action committees a lot of money to a handful of key races. But it is very grassroots in the sense that, you know, Soros's people have to kind of find the specific races to donate to.
This is a test, though. Can a district attorney using this model, prison reform, keeping people from going to prison for limited reasons and creating reform alternatives to prison as a sort of power base being district attorney, is that going to make you a strong community leader as the old throw in and throw away the key, lock the door, throw away the key kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a tension. I mean, we are the only country, as far as I know, that elects district attorneys, one of the only countries that elects judges. You know, we have a kind of direct democratic lever on these people. In many other countries, they're completely non-political. And this creates a kind of tension. You know, a big example of this was in Baltimore, where Marilyn Mosby is the district attorney and has been for a little while now. She was under tremendous pressure to prosecute the officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray. And then when she did prosecute them, she was accused of doing it for her own political ambitions. And then
and
when
she wasn't
lost,
successful. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when she lost, it was seen as a liability next time she runs for office. So the fact that these offices are becoming politicized, I think, makes a lot of people who watch the system very closely a little bit nervous. An example of that is defense attorneys who say, what if my client isn't going to get the deal they should get because the district attorney is trying to get votes by doing one thing or another in my case?
A potential sea change in the criminal justice system, looking at district attorney races. Maurice Chama is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The 20th century brought into being all of the transnational global institutions that form today's rickety consensus we call the international community. Well, that consensus is feeling the shockwaves of war and peace in this century, from the Security Council stymied to help the situations in Syria and Yemen, to the European Union feeling the surprising consequences of the departure of the suddenly ununited kingdom, to the International Criminal Court now facing its own looming crisis of credibility. South Africa has become the second African country following Burundi to announce its intention to withdraw from the ICC, and more African countries have indicated they might follow suit, saying that the ICC unfairly targets the continent while Western leaders go unprosecuted. South Africa last year defied the ICC's arrest warrant for Sudanese President
Omar al-Bashir, who's been accused of crimes against humanity. Every person tried by the ICC has been African. Kamari Clark is a professor of global and international studies at Carleton University, author of Fictions of Justice. She says the credibility of the ICC now hangs in the balance.
The credibility is certainly an issue right now, especially in relation to the track record. This is a difficult situation for the ICC. All of the cases have been African cases, as we know, and it's a shock to liberal institutionalism. So this is a deeply troubling set of issues.
Why would the international community have created a separate tribunal for Yugoslavia to try the leaders in Eastern Europe in that conflict? Why wouldn't they have been tried by the ICC?
Well, this was long before the ICC came into force, so there was no ICC at the time. And it was after the violence in the former Yugoslavia, the violence in Rwanda, when the world community stood and watched and didn't actually intervene, that we then had, you know, a moral impetus to put in place this mechanism that would adjudicate crimes for mass atrocities.
From South Africa's perspective, what's the alternative to honoring the arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir and sending him to the ICC to be tried? Is there some way of trying him elsewhere? The South African government has not offered asylum for Omar al-Bashir at this point, it seems.
Right. It hasn't offered asylum. And remember, Sudan hasn't ratified the Rome Statute. So technically, it actually isn't under the jurisdiction of the ICC. And that's a technical issue that is still under deliberation. And many diplomats and others raise this question. And, you know, one of South Africa's positions is that it won't support regime change, that the Rome Statute is inconsistent with customary international law, as well as the Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges Act that South Africa signed and is obliged to follow. So the alternatives really are to address these questions domestically, as well as to turn possibly to the looming regional court that has been constructed over the last year. It's not in force yet, but countries have signed the protocol, so the treaty, to put in place a new mechanism that is in Africa that will deal with a range of crimes and as a result of mass atrocities.
Back to the ICC, the U.S., of course, is not a signatory. And why is that the case? Just remind us, Kamari.
It's not just the U.S. It's also Japan, China, India, Pakistan, a lot of the Middle East. There are a lot of quite powerful and economically strong countries that are not under its jurisdiction. And for the most part, the technical issues have to do with the arrest of heads of state, and as well as a number of other issues, but in particular, making leaders of countries responsible for the crimes of soldiers and others who commit these crimes is something that the U.S. as well as a number of other countries felt uncomfortable with.
Kamari Clark is professor of global and international studies at Carleton University, author of Fictions of Justice, The International Criminal Court, and the Challenge of Legal Pluralism in Sub-Saharan Africa. Kamari, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Was it a Nobel Peace Prize for trying and E for effort? When Colombia's President Juan Manuel Santos was awarded the prize for negotiating peace to end a five-decades-old civil war with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, better known as FARC, the people of Colombia had already said no to the deal in a national referendum. For the thousands of Colombians scarred by war and brutality, the surprising vote has caused an inward look at the consequences of war. And what everyone is discovering is that peace prizes cannot silence voices still crying out for justice. This is the lesson of some remarkable reporting from Jasmine Garst, who's been telling the story of how justice and reconciliation for the people of Colombia is not to be found in Stockholm, but in individual hearts willing to reach out and embrace a painful process of forgiveness. Garst is a reporter with PRI's Across Women's Lives project.
I found out about this school that is called the School of Reconciliation and Forgiveness. It's run by a priest. His name is Leonel Narvaez. He has such an interesting story. He grew up in a humble family, coffee growers, and when he was a teenager, his little brother joined the FARC guerrilla. And he was at a loss. He had this kind of existential crisis, and a few months later, he became a priest, and he dedicated his whole life to conflict resolution. He participated in the last peace talks, which fell apart in 2000. And he says something that he realized was that what these peace talks don't deal with is with human emotion. The reality is people feel hate and they feel anger and they feel a desire for revenge and they're hurt. And if you don't work on that on an individual level, the country is just not going to move forward.
Well, you really get a sense of Father Narvaez being motivated by his personal emotional connection to all of this when you hear him speak.
I thought I needed to do something for my country and for my area. I was inspired by my brother because he decided to take arms, guns. And I decided I'm not going to take guns. I'm going to work with the arms of spirituality. Yeah. Let me work with the heart of human beings.
And he also provides the insight, and again, this is from an exchange that you had in an interview with him, that people misunderstand what happened in the referendum, that in many ways it's about not understanding precisely that rage. Listen.
The big problem at this moment in Colombia, and perhaps the big problem why people voted or rejected the agreement with the FARC, is the problem of justice. How we understand justice. And, you know, people are asking for punishment. People are asking to put people in jail.
But isn't that justice?
No, that's not justice. That's a very archaic, that's a very primitive justice. Yeah. And I think that the world is really changing this kind of mentality. Justice is not to destroy your offender. It's to how to recuperate your offender.
And his attempt to have an impact here is to create this foundation for reconciliation, which runs these schools of forgiveness that you actually visited. What is happening at these schools of reconciliation and forgiveness that you think can have an impact, small, but certainly very emotional and very meaningful to the individuals who are taking part?
Talking. A lot of talking about what happened. And one of the women I spoke to, her name is Flor. She had this very harrowing story. She works as a coordinator for the School of Reconciliation in the Amazon region. And, you know, she described how initially, when she was just a displaced civilian, not a coordinator, she could not talk to these people. She had so much hatred in her heart. Just the backstory is that her son was killed by the paramilitary and her father was a civilian killed in a confrontation between the military and the guerrillas. So she really got it from all sides. And all she wanted was revenge. Revenge is on everyone's mind. And this project is trying to move people past revenge in a country where, you know, half of the people who voted in this referendum said, nope, I still want punishment.
How did this reconciliation school and this process of talking have an impact on that burning sense of revenge for Flor Rojas?
She was about 8 months into a process which was run by the Colombian government of helping people psychosocially, you know. And a priest tells her, listen, we are going to have a meeting with former combatants. Would you like to come? And she said, absolutely not. Do not mention those people to me. I do not want to see them. And then she starts coming around to it. And she goes to one of these meetings in which it's victims, victimizers, former combatants, orphans, widows, everyone. But they're all dressed as civilians. So she can't tell who is who. And there's this young man talking, and he's talking about how when he was 7 years old, the FARC kidnapped him. and how the first time he killed, the person who he killed said, "Please don't do this. I'm someone's dad." And all he could think about was, "Yeah, I used to have a dad, and now I don't." And she starts feeling really bad for him.
Yo escuchaba, sentía mucho dolor.
I listened, and I felt a lot of pain. I felt like palpitations because I was judging him. And then I said, no, what if this, what if he's the one who hurt me so much? And then I wondered, but what if it wasn't him? I asked myself so many questions.
How do you think she's permanently changed? And what do you think the chance is of a large number of Colombians having the same kind of transformation that would move the country forward?
You know, I think she changed. The whole experience changed her in that she was able to do something that I think is kind of rare, actually. She was able to see her victimizers as victims. She was able to take a step back and say, wow, it's like a big cycle of hurt. You know how they say hurt people hurt people. Can an entire nation do that? Oh, I mean, that is the big question, right? I mean, can they? And also, you know what, should they? I mean, women have borne the brunt of this conflict. Should a woman who was raped or made a sex slave, should she forgive? I mean, I asked Father Narvaez that, and he said, the reason people need to forgive is for their own good, because that's the only way you get out of the role of being a victim. So, I don't know.
Jasmine, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jasmine Guards is a reporter for Across Women's Lives. Among the feelings of change all around us, I think there's been a hint of a new openness and candor regarding race in America. The political campaign shows that people are tired of simplistic rhetoric, that's for sure. Support the police versus police brutality is all racism. There is a recognition that the violence resulting in the deaths of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Akai Gurley, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, is reflected in tensions unspoken, anger unvoiced, privilege unacknowledged, freedom and equality still out of reach for Americans. Is there a role that each of us can play in speaking of those tensions, angers, privileges, speaking openly, speaking one race to another, one person to another? To step over suspicion and awkwardness to find some new place? We think so. And over the next several weeks, we plan to bring you straightforward, candid, sometimes painful one-on-one conversations about race. We're inspired by a project from writer Rebecca Carroll. It's a series called How I Got Over. We'll be hearing some of her conversations here on The Takeaway. Her first is with actor Ethan Hawke, and we'll hear that next week. But Rebecca's mantra is, let's just start talking. And so we did. We found out a lot about each other as we stepped through some awkward territory to find truth and a new understanding, two people at a time.
Well, so the series is really largely inspired by a Toni Morrison quote, which is that we die. That may be the meaning of life, but we do language, and that may be the measure of our lives. And I really do believe that. And this conversation that we keep talking about, the difficult conversation about race, has always been important. But why it's particularly important now is that there is a window of heightened receptivity. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's just a trend or some kind of Gladwellian tipping point, we need to take that moment, that window, and really get in there and really move beyond the uncomfortable. Because I don't really think most white people certainly understand just how uncomfortable we need to get. It's sort of like, get uncomfortable, sit in that discomfort, and then keep talking. And I think that that's really the challenge.
What should I do about my white privilege? Period, the end.
Okay. So rather, that's maybe not the question to ask, but because you have it and you've been operating in the world with it, right? You're not going to give it away.
I'm a guy in a wheelchair. I'm not supposed to have any privilege, but I still have it anyway.
That's
so it's
right.
So it's like white trumps wheelchair.
White trumps everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious, though, as a father and you know, somebody who is clearly knowledgeable on the issue of race. I mean, how do you talk to your kids? How do you talk to your peers? How do you talk at dinner parties? How do you have those conversations with your children who you hope will be citizens who care about these things, but not in a way that puts their privilege before their consciousness?
My children, here's what happens. My children come to me and they go, why are we just white? And I say, what are you talking about? And they go, we have no story. We're just here. And we're the bad guys. And how did that happen? And how did that? Oh, it's endless. And it's and I go, you're right. You're right. And we are the bad guys. And in fact, if there was a way to undo the bad guy thing, I would love to do it. But I think these are really important.
No question. No question. You know, I was adopted into a white family, and I was raised in a white town, and was the only black student for most of my schooling, almost all of my schooling, in fact. And I sort of, you know, I've strung together this livelihood and career based almost entirely on inquiry and conversation, particularly around race, as I began experiencing and witnessing and being the target of racism, you know, very, very early on, and having nobody to help sort of guide me through that. And I knew that the only way that I would be able to understand it and survive it would be to have conversations and ask questions, and that would bring me all the way through. I was only presented with a white default, and I knew that that would not serve me, and I knew that that might even act, you know, against me.
What do you mean a white default?
Everything around me. Everything around me. My family, my school, my town. Everything was white. Everything on TV almost, except, you know, The Cosby Show and Oprah and, you know, Garrett, whoever.
Morris.
On Saturday Night Live. But, you know, in terms of friends and teachers and, I mean.
Who didn't help you? Who could have?
Oh, my parents, for sure.
Really?
Oh, for sure. You know, they were and are extraordinary people, artists, intellectuals, who were always sort of on the kind of laxer side of parenting. Very, you know, my dad liked to think of the five of us as pre-Garibaldi Italy, you know, like we were all sort of like independent nation states, you know, but connected and loosely, you know.
You were Naples.
I don't know who I was, but I really could have used the guidance. It was further complicated by the fact that I had a relationship with my white birth mother, who really was only interested in loving the part of me that she created, which was the white part, and really erased the black part. And then even further complicated by wanting to find my black birth father, who was demonized by my white birth mother and broken by the system when I did finally find him. So there were a lot of factors involved. But what I did know that was that I would have to talk my way through it, not talk my way out of it, but talk my way through it with a kind of persistent, you know, vulnerable and also really ambitious approach.
Can we connect some of these discussions to actual political change? For instance, can we connect a discussion about the incarceration rate to concrete changes that will reduce the population at Rikers? Can we turn a conversation about segregated New York into a what would we do to make it less segregated?
I mean, these are questions of every age, of every era. I don't have a ton of hope all the time, but that is the one place where I really enlist whatever hope I have left. You know, it's like what Julian Bond said to me when he was still alive. You know, the struggle is long, you know, and we just have to forge onward, and we have to hope that these conversations will lead to some kind of political change.
I sometimes think the abstract notion of equality kills us, because sometimes things can meet the test of equal opportunity, but the outcomes are so obviously unequal that we're not solving the problem that we want to solve.
Yeah, and it's also very much about, you know, I think of that situation when Hillary Clinton talked with the young folks of Black Lives Matter earlier on in her campaign, and she said, "You're not going to change hearts and minds." I feel like that's all we kind of have, you know, because clearly we've tried all measure of policies. And yes, ultimately, that is how we live in this country, by legislature and policy. But race and racism and white supremacy and structural systemic racism is as much policy as it is people's hearts and minds. So for me, my approach is hearts and minds through dialogue.
Rebecca Carroll is editor for special projects here at WNYC, and she's helping us launch a series of conversations over the next several months trying to tackle honest and difficult discussions about race,
Next week, we'll bring you her first conversation in the series with actor Ethan Hawke.
I was at the Oscars sitting next to Denzel Washington when he won the Oscar, right? And Halle Berry also won that year. And there was a great feeling. Sidney Poitier was being honored there that night. And Denzel got up and said, you know, I'm following you my whole life. And it was very kind of beautiful. And it really felt like, to me, in the room, that isn't it great that all that stuff is behind us?
Ethan Hawke on race in Hollywood and in his personal life. That's next week in our series, Uncomfortable Truths, Confronting Racism in America. Rebecca Carroll is also hosting a series of events in WNYC's Green Space on Friday, November 18th. Kristen Davis from Sex and the City will join Rebecca for a conversation about interracial adoption. For tickets, visit WNYC.org/thegreenspace. That's G-R-E-E-N-E. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.